In East Timor, just to the north of Australia, the typical wage for a farmer is about 80 cents a day. Given that, it's not surprising that rural landholders there in Timor are jumping at the chance to boost their income by growing trees. They get paid about 50 cents per tree per year. It's part of a scheme devised by my next guest, Andrew Marr, who's the founder of an organisation called With One Seed. Andrew, thanks for coming into Bush Telegraph. Nice to have you along.
Yeah, pleasure.
You're an IT specialist by trade, aren't you?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say an IT specialist. I mean, most of what I've done in my life has been learnt along the way.
Okay.
So I spent 25 years building a not-for-profit IT business called InfoExchange Australia, which was established around a vision of technology for social justice. And I started that after having worked on the streets of inner Melbourne with homeless people and the frustration of being able to find a bed for the night.
Mm-hmm.
So we set up a system that was, in a sense, like the first What If, but before the internet was around, where the beds that were vacant in night shelters and youth refuges got registered centrally on a computer, and you could dial into the computer and find out where that information was. It was about trying to remove the demoralisation of homeless people who would sit in a waiting room in a community organisation waiting for a worker to be able to locate a bed, and we're trying to improve the efficiency of that.
So was it that work and those skills around computers that got the attention of the former Premier Steve Brax?
Yeah, it was. In 2002, when Steve Brax went to Timor to open Australia House, which was the house near where, in Balibo, where the Balibo Five were murdered. He visited the Dili Institute of Technology and said to them that the Victorian government would help to get the technology sorted out in their computer training room. And when he came back to Australia, I got asked to go over and have a look and see what could be done. And so I went with a couple of colleagues, and we managed to get the Dili Institute of Technology's technology up and running.
Mm.
But it was pretty apparent to me that within a month, 3 months, 6 months, when it all started to fall apart, that there was no one there with the skills to be able to keep it running. So I came back and said to Steve and his people that, you know, what we really need to do is bring some people out to our workshops. At this time at InfoExchange, we were running a program called Green PC, which I started in the year 2000 when the world was going to end because the Y2K bug was going to stop everything.
That's a distant memory now, isn't
it? Yeah, and you remember the panic that everybody had at that
time. Planes were going to fall out of the sky, weren't they?
And so people were getting rid of their computers, and we put up our hands, and we ended up having 3,000 of these computers stored in sheds and garages around inner Melbourne. And we set up a business called Green PC that started to refurbish and fix those up. So we had workshops that were fixing up old computers, and so I said that we would bring six young Timorese people out to our workshops and put them through a training program that would allow them to go back and have the skills to be able to fix everything and keep it going.
Mm. So you've always had, or for a long time, had this interest in social justice and a social conscience. But how do you make that leap from a bit of a tech head, if you like, in working in East Timor to someone who becomes interested in planting trees around Timor?
Doesn't it sound natural progression to you?
One of the things I
used to do when I was in Timor, I'd sort of have a bin town at night and think about in the villages, how are these people going to be able to move beyond the subsistence living that they were in, as you said at the start, people living on 80 cents a day, a subsistence living where they get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, they go out into the fields and they eke out their living, and it's a pretty hard life. Mm. And, you know, I know that I wouldn't survive in a place like that. If I was just plonked there and said, you know, you've got to survive, I would really struggle with that sort of thing. And I read one time over there, I read Now or Never, which is a book by Tim Flannery, and in there he had a chapter called About Trees for Security, which was talking about getting subsistence farmers in the Asia-Pacific rainforest belt to look at maintaining the forests they were living in, and maintaining them for two purposes. One was because you know, that's where they got their livelihood, the farmers, but also trees sequester carbon, and we have a pretty serious problem in our society around the greenhouse gases that are around, and we need to ensure that there's trees that suck that in and sequester that.
Mm.
And he presented in this book an idea around saying, well, if you get the farmers to maintain that, you can set up a technology resource centre in the village, and the farmers can then get into carbon trading, and kids can use the technology for their education, and you can start to build something. And that sort of appealed to me.
Mm.
And it sort of just took off from there.
Snowballed. So before we get into the nuts and bolts, if you like, of how the scheme actually works, when you arrived for the first time in Timor, what sort of landscape did you see?
Oh, look, it was a year after independence. The place had been pretty well devastated by the Indonesians when they left. They burned and trashed and did all sorts of horrible things there. It was a pretty confronting sort of place. I'd been not involved in the Timor issue. I'd gone to rallies and demonstrations and stuff like that around Melbourne and places over the years, and always been tables about Timor, East Timor, and the issue there, but hadn't paid terribly much attention to it, much to my... I should have paid more attention. Yeah. Back
so
then.
Were you expecting lush forests and thick canopies and what?
I'm not sure what I was really expecting, but I wasn't expecting a place that had been devastated, that was like a bomb site.
But at a time where people have lost loved ones and family, the death is around, a nation's being reborn, I guess, in East Timor's sense, surely deforestation and concern about trees isn't top priority.
Well, maybe not, but in another way, because it was a subsistence society, and the forest that was there in 1975 covered around 50%. Of the country.
75, so people would remember that. There were living people that remember the landscape.
That landscape. And I now go with people who are in their 40s when I'm up in the villages and stuff and walk through and talk to them about what was there before. And we would walk through area where they would be saying when they were kids they wouldn't be able to see the sky because of the canopy of the forest. And now you can clearly see the sky and things. And whilst it looks lush and green, most of what's there is weed and stuff that has grown since, but it's not the rich, lush forests that were there. And one of the impacts of deforestation then is erosion, soil degradation. You go there and when the rivers are running, they're running a rich chocolate brown colour, wonderful colour in a way, but then you think...
But it's bad news.
It's bad news. Yeah. This is all the soil from up in the mountains. And you then see when it washes out into the sea, you get great clouds of brown into the beautiful blue waters and things like that, and so people recognise that the deforestation had a big impact upon their ability then to be able to grow crops and keep the soil there to be able to survive, and that they took to this in a pretty big way. Mm.
You're listening to Bush Telegraph on RN. My guest is Andrew Marr, who's the founder of an organisation called With One Seed. It operates in East Timor and essentially provides an income for farmers there to plant trees. Andrew, how does it work? How do you derive an income for farmers in exchange for planting trees?
Mm. So With One Seed has four commitments. It has a commitment around reforestation and putting the forest back, not only for improving the soil and potentially the opportunity to be able to get better crop yields and things like that, but also it has a direct link into Australia, that the atmosphere knows no borders, and so Australians are one of the biggest emitters, and we have one of the biggest carbon emissions per capita in the world. The Timorese have one of the lowest, but all of our carbon that we create gets picked up in the sky and gets blown across the world. And so if we can put the forest back in Timor, that will then have an impact of sucking the carbon out.
Mm. But where does the money come from? Who pays for it?
So the idea that I was talking about before that Tim Flannery had was that the forests that got replaced could then get put into the international carbon market. And so farmers would then be able to derive an income from selling the carbon offsets into the international carbon market. Unfortunately, the global financial crisis came along and the price of
carbon's not so great.
Yeah, the carbon market collapsed. But I was fortunate in being able to talk with CEO of a large Australian global company who accepted that trees sequest carbon. Do you actually need to know the exact amount of carbon that's being sequestered? Possibly not. But if you then said, you know, you're planting trees, you know that's good, they were willing to then put the money on the table for 3 years to get the program going and for us then to be able to be paying the farmers.
Well, on a voluntary basis, just for their social reputation.
Just through their organisation. They have a foundation that supports, does lots of work in around the globe. And I went and presented a case to them saying that, you know, maybe they ought to think about doing some work a little bit closer to home in Timor, and they accepted that. So the idea was then they would put that as part of their foundation's activity. And we had a look at getting the project certified, but getting certified through one of the standards, gold standard or one of those standards, was going to cost around $120,000. And that was primarily to pay consultants to come and tell us that we were doing the right thing and tick the boxes and things.
And make sure it was measured accurately.
Yeah. And we thought, you know, $120,000 to consultants who are probably doing okay, as opposed to keeping that money and putting it into village activities and building a technology resource centre and doing all those sort of things, we decided we'd put the money there.
Which means, I guess, the credits cannot be sold then on the international market, even if it does recover and the price goes through the roof.
At this point in time, that's true. But I've just been fortunate to have another group come along and say, we're happy to provide the funds to you to go and get certified. So there's been some significant changes in the standards, and now for around $50,000 we can get the project certified, which will then mean we'll be able to put the carbon into the international market. Certainly we won't get the pricing that we were hoping to get, around $23 a tonne. It's dropped down to $6 or $7 a tonne at the present time. But it's also one of those learning things, I think, that farmers need to understand in Timor, that if they're going to play in the market, then the market fluctuates and you've got to work out that sort of stuff.
What do they plant? What sort of trees?
Currently we're just planting mahogany trees. Mahogany, teak and sandalwood are the three trees that we're looking at. And we've just decided to focus on one species at this point in time, just to prove the case that this thing will work. There are quite a number of other tree planting initiatives and activities going on in Timor and in other places, but none of them, from what we can see, have a model where people get paid to do it. And so the idea is building the economy of these local villages, so that the money that we pay and a farmer gets 500 trees, we give them 500 trees, so they can earn $250 a year, which in many cases...
When you're on 80 cents a day, was it?
Yeah, more than doubles their annual income.
I assume that there's no land clearing or anything, though. They just have to use the land in its existing state, do they?
Yeah, absolutely. This is replanting natural forests. Yeah. It's not plantation forest or anything like that. It's going in onto their land and planting trees in their existing land. They don't make any clearings at all. The idea is, if the tree is planted and then survives, it will grow and the canopy will then kill off what's underneath it. Mm-hmm. So you're getting rid of the things that you don't want underneath that. We're also having a look around the idea of agroforestry and then looking at cocoa and coffee and fruit and nut trees and things like that also then can provide sustenance and edible opportunities for them to be able to have a variety of food sources in this program.
Mahogany, sandalwood, teak, reasonably high value wood products. Can the farmers ultimately cut the trees down, or is that out of the question?
No, well that's the plan, that within 25 to 30 years time there can be a selective harvesting program, and so a timber industry can be established there.
And what you argue, the carbon's then trapped in the furniture or the final product that's made, so it's not
exactly
released?
Right. That's how the thing works. And so they can. The plan will be that they'll get paid their 50 cents or whatever the market value is on the way through while the trees are growing, and then once they get to maturity, they can then be harvested. But on the understanding that you're replacing whatever you harvest, and that it's a selective harvest. So we've established a tree cooperative in the village, and so everybody belongs to the tree cooperative and is accountable to the tree cooperative, so you can't just go down and start cutting down your own trees and things like that. You've got to go and get permissions and do all those sort of things.
Mm-hmm. Has it been quite a learning curve for the farmers, not so much the practice of farming, I'm sure they know that backwards, but to learn a thing or two about carbon and the carbon cycle and the process here?
Yeah, that's really interesting. We have a relationship with the Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne, and the third commitment, I only got through two of the commitments, the third commitment of With One Seed is around open education and looking at trying to ensure that we educate people about the carbon and the carbon cycle, that we educate people about culture and get them to understand each other's culture, and to also educate people around being global citizens. And we need to ensure that young people in Australia understand that they are, their activities are impacting upon these poor places. Mm-hmm. And so the education is really pretty critical to all of that sort of thing. And we run an education environment, an environmental education week in the village. And last year we ran that around the carbon cycle. And we took up with us, with the people from the gardens, we took a soda siphon with us, and SodaStream, you know, that's a brand name, sorry, on the ABC.
Putting bubbles in your water, though, however you want to do it.
Yeah. But that's carbon that's coming out of that. So it's carbon's going into the water, and it was really quite an amazing experience because I had never seen anything like this sort of thing. You push the button, psh, and you're talking about carbon and how bad it is, and then you're saying, well, here it is, do you want to drink it? And so it was fascinating. But what really struck me was that the level of understanding and comprehension that the kids and the teachers had in the 35 schools we worked with was much higher than I imagined it to be. And they understood and appreciated a lot of what we were talking about carbon and that carbon gets trapped in the trees and the importance of all of that sort of stuff. And this year we're going and we're running a program around identifying plants. One of the things that happened in Timor when the Indonesians were in there, the areas we're working in were napalmed, similar to what happened in Vietnam to get rid of the jungle so that they could find the resistance fighters and things like that. And then the people who were in the mountains, there was famine and hunger and stuff like that. And so that's had a big impact on the people living in those areas. And the people who are in their late 40s to early 50s are all dying. And so the knowledge they have is disappearing. And so part of the program we're now working on is looking at going and identifying the plants in the villages and what they're used for. So if they're used for medicinal things or if they're used for edible things or what they're... and identify that so that the young people understand what plants are there and then use the old people to educate that. And so the gardens are... The Botanic Gardens in Melbourne are sending a botanist with us to start this process around plant identification. And I remember at school you used to go and grab a plant and you put it between a press and you'd press it and then write the scientific name and what it was used for. That's the sort of thing that we're going to go and do.
Wow, I know you're flying back in a matter of days. I bet when you look out the plane window now, you see the landscape in a whole new light than when you first flew in.
I do. It's great.
Yeah. Well, safe travels. Thank you so much for coming in today and telling us all about how With One Seed actually works.
Yeah, pleasure.
That's Andrew Marr, who is the founder of With One Seed.